This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss to round up the week's top stories that they've been covering on their award-winning website. And last week, we had the happiness episode, didn't we, where every story had to end on a positive note. Today, though, I fear the watchword will be caution. A winning streak for the FTSE.
Markets in general this year have got off to a pretty solid start, and they've really been helped by a continuation of the trends that we saw at the tail end of last year.
But just how far will the bull run? Is now the time to invest, or should we be more sensible? Brexit, we heard this week from one Mark Carney, no less, is not the biggest threat to the economy.
And there are economic risks to the UK, but there are greater financial stability risks on the continent in the short term for the transition than there are for the UK.
Well, that doesn't mean it's all rainbows and moonbeams going forward. First-time buyers are entering the market in record numbers, but
the average deposit is now £32,000. That's around double what it was 10 years ago.
We had Super Thursday this week, nothing to do with the Bank of England. Retailers posting some good Christmas numbers.
I think it's truly, you know, the most wonderful time of year for supermarkets. Both Sainsbury's and Lidl, you know, they come out with some really strapping set of results.
But with Brexit on the horizon, can it last? We also ask, how rich are you? Probably not feeling so wealthy if you're a travel agency manager or careers advisor. We look at the best paid jobs, which saw the biggest pay rises last year, and those who are losing out. But to cheer, well, Simon up at least, we talk cars. Which are the best new vehicles on the market? But it's Friday the 13th. If you want a cheap house and you aren't particularly superstitious, then you could save yourself, we're hearing, as much as £9,000 if you don't mind living, yes, at number 13. This is according to Zoopla, who say nearly a third of home buyers are less likely to buy a property with this number. And it's not just homes. It can also be cheaper to fly or indeed to get married on Friday the 13th. So I want to know, a very good morning, Simon, a very good morning, Rachel, what are your superstitions? Simon, to you first.
I can be quite superstitious with things. I'm the kind of person who avoids saying things that they don't want to happen, thinks that, you know, he can somehow change the future when the future cannot obviously be changed by just thinking about stuff or saying stuff, or actually even things that have happened in the past but I don't know about yet. There's that classic one of the sports result you don't know, the thing that's happened but you don't know the answer to, and you keep hanging on to it. But I guess probably my biggest and most annoying one, and one that I have been doing for many years of my life now, walking over two drain covers for luck and not walking over three because it's bad luck.
Did I know that you did that as well?
We've had this conversation before. Yeah.
Everybody thinks I'm bananas. Where did this come from, Simon? Because I don't know,
I was at school as a teenager. Everybody did it. Well, not everybody did it. Only idiots did it, like me. But the thing about idiotic behaviour is it does have a tendency to catch on. So there are any number of people who do it.
It still continues many years later.
It drives my wife mad. We're walking down the street and all of a sudden she gets shoulder barged out the way as I desperately try to avoid a three drain cover run. Or people will watch this strange man walk down the street, realise he's walked over two and then jump over the third one. And just to make sure that I'm really annoying my wife, I've started trying to teach my kids to do it too.
Oh no, Simon. I'm so glad you said that, because I agree with you. People must think I'm absolutely bananas, and I don't just shoulder barge the people I'm with. I'm strangers as well. Out of the way, I can't step on three. Do you find it's good luck if you step on more, like six or four? That's extra good luck.
If it's a multiple of two, that's good luck. If it's three, then that's bad luck. Obviously, there does come a point where you could get potentially six, which is a multiple of two or a multiple of three. Glass half full kind of guy. The good luck outweighs the bad luck, so that's fine. That's three lots of two rather than two lots of three. Obviously, there does come a point where you're unlikely to get more than a certain number of drain covers in a row. For example, I don't think I've ever encountered a nine.
No, that would be super bad luck.
Yeah, you are listening to a certified idiot talking on the radio here.
It's Rachel, join the party.
Thanks. I can't think of any at all. But I know that I'll leave and find myself, you know, switching a light on and off three times or jumping over things or whatever, and then I'll remember them.
Touch wood? Do you touch wood?
T- To be polite, I do. If I've sort of...
You're going to have to explain that.
If I've said something that may jinx someone who I'm with such that I may have, you know, inadvertently caused their death, then to be polite, I will touch wood. I have irrational fears.
Yeah.
Definitely. Fire is one, which is a problem because I've just started a welding course. But superstitions, not that I can think of, unless they're so deep-rooted that I don't even think of them as such.
If I'd have known you were going to say that, I'd have got some flash dance music. A welding course? I can't let that one slide. Who cares about superstitions? A welding course?
Oh, it's so fun. I'm going to make a table.
Right. You never know where this is going to go. Love it.
On digital radio across the UK and online, this is Share Radio.
Well, we do know exactly where we're going to go. We are going to go to the FTSE. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the financial website of the year. This is Money. I'm back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and welder come personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. So are we in line for another week of happy podcasting? It certainly seems so. FTSE on a winning streak. Mark Carney saying Brexit is no longer the biggest threat to our economy. Good news as well. We're hearing the first-time buyers, and it was a very Merry Christmas for a number of retailers. But after last episode's positivity, it's time to come back down to earth. This is the more sensible edition. Heading first to the UK's top shares on a winning streak this week, up 15% from its immediate post-Brexit blues. How far does the bull really have to run?
We've already seen over the course of the past 12 months how markets have shrugged off the concerns that were expressed about the effects of a Brexit vote, the effects of Trump winning the presidential election, and more importantly, the effects of the Italian referendum vote. Ultimately, it's a question of what is going to derail the current positive momentum for markets. And at the moment, there doesn't appear to be any evidence that we are going to see that positive momentum come to an end. Now, I would say that obviously the Trump inauguration is one factor that actually could derail things, but I think that's a story from maybe the end of Q1, beginning of Q2, perhaps, as we get some better idea of the type of president Mr. Trump is likely to be.
That was Michael Hewson, chief market analyst at CMC Markets, speaking there. Here's senior FX strategist at Rabobank, Jane Foley.
For the FTSE in particular, it's difficult to view this index in isolation from the movement in sterling. If you were to put the movements in the FTSE in another currency's terms, if you were to view them in US dollar terms, or if you were to view them in terms of the euro, you would simply not see the gains that we've seen. For exporters, for instance, there is a considerable potential advantage to having a weaker sterling. Similarly, for people buying FTSE in terms of euro, or US investors buying FTSE, the weakness of sterling has created a significant advantage for them.
So, Simon, didn't someone more knowledgeable than I, it's not hard though, once proclaim that bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on scepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria? Firstly, why is the FTSE so high?
The FTSE is so high because, broadly speaking, it has risen as the pound has fallen. So the FTSE 100 is not really a great barometer of UK business. It's a great barometer of international businesses that do business all over the world and happen to be listed on the London stock market. And they're all doing quite well. Thank you very much. Now, there's a number of factors. First one is basically since the Brexit vote, the pound has fallen substantially. Pound against the dollar, it's fallen 18%, something like that. And the FTSE is up about 15%. And against the euro, it is down slightly less. But the reason is basically all of these big companies, they earn quite a lot of their money overseas. And when they earn that money overseas, and then it's moved back into the, or translated back into the UK, into pounds and pence for their results and their profits, what it's going to do is it's going to generate more profits in pounds and pence, because that money from overseas is essentially worth more in sterling. Our money in sterling is worth less overseas. Money from overseas is worth more here. So what you're going to see is a shift upwards in earnings. Mm-hmm. Why does that mean the share prices have risen? Even if you just applied the same valuation or same average valuation across the market to these companies as you do now, then if the earnings shift up and they're valued at, say, for example, 15 times their price, then the price to earnings ratio there, you know, if the earnings go up, then if it stays at 15, then the price goes up by a similar magnitude. What then also happens is if people think that companies, if investors think that companies are going to do well, that they're going to continue to grow, that these earnings are going to continue to increase, then they might be willing to pay more for that company. So that price to earnings ratio might stretch. So actually it might go from, say, 15 to 18 or to 20. If they think that those companies might be able to pay out more money in dividends, which actually in pounds and pence, they will be able to pay out more money in dividends because their earnings are going to be higher. They're going to be getting more money from overseas, which means they can pay out more in dividends to their shareholders here. Investors might prize those dividends more highly and they might be willing to pay more for the share price. There is a chart that we've published before, which is sort of a mirror chart, which it shows the pound going down against the dollar and the FTSE going up. And uncannily, the two lines move very, very similarly together since about a week after Brexit. Now, obviously, the issue here is that everybody knows about this effect now, and this effect is limited because they're, you know, unless the pound just keeps falling and falling and falling, there will come a point where this effect of overseas earnings making profits rise will just stop. It'll plateau. So the question is, what happens then? Are the businesses then still going to be in a good position? Are they good businesses? Are they going to be earning more money? So then you move into the situation where you look at the external stuff going on, which is investors have decided that Trump, despite his slightly erratic behaviour, is going to be good for business. Mm-hmm. And that's going to mean more profits, especially for big companies. How's that for smashing the global elite? More profits for big companies. And also that the oil price is rising. FTSE 100 companies, got a lot of oil companies in there. Commodity prices are up, miners are up. Banks have been doing well off this thought that regulation is going to be eased. So you've got all of these things feeding into the fact that the FTSE 100 has now hit a record-breaking run of highs over the end of 2016 and start of 2017, which is really, really weird for those of us who spent an awful long time waiting for the FTSE 100 to regain the peak that it hit on the 31st of December 1999. Some 15 years, if I remember rightly.
How long will the bull run? Does it have further to go from here? Are you on the Hargreaves Lansdown side, which says it's the most unloved bull market of my career, I think one investor called it. Are you a touch more pessimistic, or with the future so uncertain, can we actually really draw any sorts of conclusions from what we've been seeing over the last couple of weeks? Rachel?
Every time we start to reach record highs, the voices start, this can't continue. Not for any particular sort of underlying reason why markets might change, but just by virtue of the fact that they have never been higher. We had a piece in Money Mail, and actually there's been lots in the papers the last week saying, is this really a good time to invest? Is this the top of the market? I mean, it is the top of the market. It's never been higher. Mm. But can it continue? And simultaneously with that, when you start to have that sort of level of uncertainty creeping in, when you have this voice getting louder saying, can it continue? That almost creates uncertainty to suggest that perhaps it can't. But nothing at the moment underlying is changing. I think the key thing is just that level of uncertainty. What's going on with Trump? And that's just the one that's in the headlines at the moment. There's so many things in the Eurozone that could kick off at any minute, and we don't hear from them once things calm down. Italy, we spoke about a lot just before Christmas, and now we don't anymore because it's out of the headlines, but it hasn't gone away. Mm. And so there's any number of things that could kick off. It's just, someone used an analogy the other day for the financial crisis, but it works just as well. It's in an avalanche. The point is not to look for which snowflake it's going to be that's going to kick things off, but just an awareness that there are several possibilities that may change dynamics.
Simon, what Rachel was talking about there, a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, but if you are a minor investor or you're a saver and you think, what on earth do I do? Should I get involved now? I mean, there's an article here on your website, why now could be the worst time to buy a big chunk of shares as the FTSE 100 hits a record run. Investors told to be careful. What's the advice?
Well, the key element in that headline is a big chunk of shares. Mm. So it's a large lump sum. And what generally happens when you see a strong run of share price rises is lots of people go, oh, hang on a minute, and what am I missing out on? I'm going to put some money in. And you find that people suddenly start to become much more optimistic about putting their money in. And people who would have been much more cautious about doing so in the past are much more tempted to do so. Now, we do have an issue where an awful lot of people who have very large amounts of cash in this country point blank refuse to put their money to work and earn a better return on it over the long term by investing. So it is difficult to know how much of that effect there will be, but we do know that that effect exists. There are many studies that have been carried out that show investor behaviour generally errs towards doing stupid stuff. There's a study in the States by a company called Dalbar, which shows how investors manage to underperform their own funds, basically because they invest at the wrong time. So they buy at the top and then they sell at the bottom, which is obviously the opposite to what you want to be doing. So not only does the average actively managed fund manage to underperform the stock market, the average investor manages to underperform the average actively managed fund. Now, the question as to whether the stock market will continue to rise, of course, is not one that I can answer because I left all my money in my coat and so I have no coin to flip, basically. But you can look at the reasons why it might continue rising. You can look at things that you might be able to know about it. And one of the things that we do know is that the FTSE 100 is not overly expensive on some measures. And you can look at the value, basically. Mm. Is it cheap? Is it expensive? Now, on one measure, the price-to-earnings ratio, which is the traditional one, the trailing price-to-earnings ratio, is massively expensive. The price-to-earnings ratio on the FTSE is above 30 at the moment. The average, long-term average, is about 16 or 17. But that is basically because a lot of companies delivered some really bad results last year, mainly due to sort of temporary factors, you know, the oil companies, the oil price crash and things like that. And that's expected to turn around. So actually the forecast PE on it is much more around the sort of long-term average level. Mm-hmm. But there's another measure that you can use, which is called Shiller PE or the CAPE ratio, and that's done over 10 years. And it basically smooths out the economic cycle and it provides a longer term view of the value of the market. And if you look at that, at the end of last year, 31st December 2016, the UK's, you know, CAPE ratio, Shiller PE, was 13. Now, the maximum, so the highest it's been, is 26. The minimum, the lowest it's been, is 6. So we're not anywhere near the maximum. Mm-hmm. We're not at the minimum, but we're not anywhere near the maximum. And the median is 14. So actually, we're slightly under the median. Now, that says that you've got, it doesn't guarantee the market's going to rise, but it says you've got quite a bit more headroom, you know, for gains than you would do, for example, if it was trading near the top of where it's been. Now, if you look at the States, on the other hand, large cap US shares, the biggest companies in the States, they currently have a Shiller PE ratio of 28. Now, the maximum is 44, but you've got to bear in mind that that came at the peak of the dot-com boom, which is basically one of the world's most famous booms. It was a temporary insanity. Mm-hmm. It's like the tulip bubble and all those other things. The minimum is 5, so it's nowhere near the minimum. And the median is 16, and that's the number to watch out for. It's at 28, the median is 16, so it's well above its median. So it's got much less headroom to have that growth. So you can look at things like value, you can look at the prospects, or you can flip a coin. Or you can remember that basically, if you are investing for the long term, and we're talking, you know, longer than 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, then it's the dividends that matter, the compounding those dividends, the time that you spend in the market, the investing your money regularly, the simple act of saving money that pays off. And so just be very careful about whacking a big lump sum in. And if you do have a big lump sum, maybe spread it out over a couple of months. So say you've got...
To drip feed it in.
Yeah, say you're lucky enough to have £20,000 to that you think, right, I don't need this £20,000 for anything in the short term. I would like to invest it. We'll take that £20,000 and put it in over the next 5 months. And then, you know, say in a month's time, the market suddenly tumbles. Well, you've at least protected yourself with the rest of the money.
Okay, so don't go all out. Don't go all in. Maybe take a little bit of profit. Leave the rest for the long term. Drip feed it in.
Very wise, Georgie.
Excellent stuff. Thank you very much, Simon. We've spoken about the FTSE over on the other side of the pond. The Dow Jones was also up. President-elect Donald Trump kicked off a fiery press conference. We know he still doesn't like the press very much. Not too keen on pharma. He's also not keen on his own intelligence agency either. He's handing over his business to his two sons. Oh, and he's a germaphobe as well. But did we actually learn anything, you know, presidential? Here's political correspondent Colin Bloom.
He's also said that the Mexican wall, remember the wall that was going to be built between the Mexico and the United States, that is going to start as soon as possible. And he said it's going to be a wall, not a fence. and it's going to start with US funding. So the US are going to pay for it, but Donald Trump has said, but in some way or other, Mexico is going to reimburse us. He's already begun the program to replace Barack Obama's affordable health care program known as Obamacare. So he said that is going to take place straight away. And he said that there was going to be a major border tax on any company that moves from the US to other nations. And that particularly has affected the car, the auto industry, where they were trying to send, you know, Ford, for example, we're going to open a factory in Mexico. Donald Trump had said, if you do that, we are going to penalize you through the tax system by bringing your cheap cars into the US. So they've rolled back on that. So, you know, we've seen some movement, some interesting comments from James Mattis and the others. But obviously this big story of, you know, very salacious story, you know, that unfortunately is the thing that's going to dominate the headlines at least for a few more days.
I imagine it will indeed. But we'll leave that to one side, Simon. I just want to ask you really briefly, how on earth do markets react to this? He got the knives out, didn't he, for pharmaceuticals this week. We saw that slump. I'd imagine if you're a CEO of a company right now, you're looking through all his biographies thinking, what does he like that you think he might tweet about and therefore your share price will fall? CEOs must be quaking.
Yes, yeah, I would imagine that they are, actually. Me and Tanya Jeffries, our investing and pensions reporter, were talking about this only yesterday evening. I mean, he said the other day that pharma was getting away with murder. Obviously, if the president-elect of the United States accuses your industry of getting away with murder, then
A pharmaceutical industry, there's obviously links there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's strong words, and it's the kind of thing that's probably going to make your share price slide. Now, it's not to say that there are not serious problems with the American medical system and the prices that are paid for drugs and all those other things. But obviously Donald Trump has a slightly different way of going about things to other politicians and leaders of countries. And it looks like we're just going to have to get used to this, because it would have been nice perhaps if someone had taken the Twitter account off him by now. But no, he's still there shouting fake news at anything that he doesn't like the sound of and accusing his former opponents of being crooked. Donald, on the off chance that you do listen to the This Is Money podcast, may I suggest that you just sit back and remember that you won the election. You are going to be president. Calm down. Chill out. Put the Twitter account down.
Social media.
And just, you know, think about stuff a little bit more. But, I mean, in all seriousness, does it get to the point where you build an index of companies that might not get trumped? So, you know, for example, would you want to invest in a car maker, an American car maker right now? No, definitely on the Trump hit list. Defense companies, he's had a pop at them. Big pharma, he's had a pop at them. I mean, Boeing got done when he tweeted about he was shocked at the price of his private jet. So you need to look for things that Trump just isn't going to be interested in. I'm not quite sure what those things are.
Does he get his biography?
I mean,
just scroll through his biography.
Write down all the things it sounds like he's got a bee in his bonnet about, scan the Twitter account, put those in an index of stuff that you don't touch or you short, then look for stuff that he's not going to be interested in. Maybe like really complicated things, perhaps. I don't
know. Stuff he's not going to touch on.
Yeah.
We're going to leave Trump to one side, talk about a special relationship. But for the pound against the dollar, not so special, falling below $1.21 at one point, the lowest level in 31 years, except for, of course, last October's flash crash, even more than Black Wednesday. Yep, it is the B word again. Theresa May hinting at a hard Brexit. It's the vagueness, though, that seems to be bothering investors. Here's Chris Beauchamp from IG Index.
To be fair to the Prime Minister, I think actually she's been quite clear on what her Brexit plan is. Certainly from the tone of the weekend's interview with Sky News, it would suggest that it means that we leave the EU in its entirety. The so-called EEA option, if you like, appears to be off the table, at least for the time being, and that we, in order to maintain control of immigration. So I think actually maybe it's a bit of an overreaction by markets. They've sort of been conditioned over the last few months to do the Pavlov's dog routine every time that Brexit is mentioned, the pound sells off. I think it's a bit of an overreaction on that front. I think it's perhaps unfair to suggest there's no plan at all. There seems to be a definite plan, and that's that Brexit will mean Brexit in its entirety, if you like. So, yeah, it is more towards the hard Brexit end, but perhaps it's just what you should have expected, really, when the UK voted to leave the European Union.
Well, asked by MPs if Brexit remains the biggest risk to the UK's financial stability, Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, more positive.
I think that the financial stability risks around that process are greater on the continent than they are for the UK. I'm not saying there are not financial stability risks to the UK, and there are economic risks to the UK, but there are greater financial stability risks on the continent in the short term for the transition than there are for the UK.
Rachel, last week we got Andy Haldane admitting economists had their Michael Fish moment. Is that it? Was Brexit a good thing after all? Or we haven't got it yet, the Brexit vote. What is the banker Mark Carney really saying?
Certainly he has toned down his gloomy rhetoric. It's positive in the sense that he's saying, well, it might be worse for Europe than it will for us, but it's not saying that it will be okay for us. And the positivity is definitely not a step down. He's still taking full credit for it. Had the Bank of England not done the things that it had done straight away, cut interest rates and made sure that the system was robust to deal with any kind of tumultuous situation in the first place, then perhaps we still would have had recession. So this is, either way, this was going to be a win for the Bank of England, depending on which way they span it. And the message is that it could be worse for Europe than it is for the UK. He has to be very careful here because, well, of course, so much of what the Bank of England says helps to determine mood, but also because, as Andy Haldane was tapping into, there is such wariness of the Bank of England, of experts in general. If he was to go either way, he would have been ripped to shreds. If he'd said, actually, Brexit, you know what, it's going to be brilliant, they'd say, oh, well, take that, Project Fear, what were you talking about? Everything you said previously was discredited. If he continues on this gloomy vein, then he's in trouble too, because all of the economic data suggests that perhaps the economists were not right.
My thinking when I heard that, okay, Brexit is not the biggest risk to the UK's financial stability. Simon, what is then?
I don't know,
or
really.
Am I just being a bit negative?
Well, I suppose the effects of Brexit, perhaps.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, I think the Bank of England got, you know, its knuckles firmly wrapped by many people for suggesting that Brexit might be an issue, and then Brexit's turned out to be absolutely fine so far. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to be an issue. And I think that possibly, actually, maybe one of the big threats to our financial stability still remains the thing that was a massive threat to our financial stability and prompted a massive crash not so long ago, which is a combination of the property market and our banking system. I'm not really sure that we've sucked all the poison out of that. And I think that people still have colossal mortgages. We're still way too dependent on high house prices. And sort of overly reliant on, we relied on them a bit to kickstart the economy after we struggled to get that growth for so long. George Osborne rolled the dice. We're still lending people interest-free cash to buy expensive new build properties. We've still got, you know, banks on the life support machine of super low interest rates and money being pumped to them with funding for lending style schemes. And we have people borrowing colossal amounts of money compared to, you know, historically speaking, to buy houses that are almost as expensive compared to their wages as they have ever been. And I do think that that still remains a fundamental issue for the UK economy. I think short term, obviously, Brexit will cause volatility. Longer term, we talked about this before the vote. You know, I was sort of siding with the argument. You know, there's a very good report put out by Neil Woodford's company, the fund manager Neil Woodford's company, that said long term, he didn't really think Brexit would make any difference to the UK economy in a sort of good or bad kind of way. So
it doesn't make such good headlines, does it?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. But it doesn't. But I still think that we do need to get to grips with this problem with the property market that we still have, whilst we're not at the point where of crisis.
Well, I want to stick on that theme, if that's all right, Simon, because we were hearing potentially good news for first-time buyers, record numbers getting on the property ladder, but deposits also up quite substantially. Here's Martin Ellis, housing economist at Halifax.
If we look at it overall, there was a big slump in number of first-time buyers as the housing market collapsed during the period from 2008 onwards. We've now seen a 75% increase since getting to a low of below 200,000 back in 2008. So we've had a period where we've now had very low mortgage rates for quite some time. We've had improving levels of employment as well. But if you add into the mix as well, we've had had a good number of government schemes which have largely been targeted at assisting numbers of first-time buyers. As we've seen, a lot of young people have been locked out of the housing market for quite some time, so that those measures from the government have also clearly helped. But I would add that things are still difficult. We know things are very difficult for young people to get into the housing market, and whilst we do have these good increases over the last few years, still bear in mind that those numbers of people buying their first homes, it's still down almost a fifth on where it was back in 2006. And we do know that a lot of people are still struggling to get together the deposit which they need. If you're to look at the UK, then the average deposit is now £32,000, and that's around double what it was 10 years ago. So people are having to put down a bigger deposit in relation to the average house price. That's now sort of 16%, whereas 10 years ago they were putting down just 10%. So things are definitely harder. And if you were to look at the position for London, then that's even more stark, where we're now recording at the average deposit being put down in the capital is around £100,000. So there's been a big increase as we've seen house prices rise quite rapidly, particularly in the capital over recent years.
You're a big fan of government schemes when it comes to housing, aren't you, Rachel?
Do you know what? My blood boiled. I thought I'd be over this by now, but no, it's terrible. Sorry, I've just reignited all this.
Sorry.
Well, we've just got rid of one, so that's good. The Help to Buy, where the government allowed the Bank of England to impose new measures to make sure that people didn't overstretch themselves, and then they simultaneously introduced special schemes whereby people could find their own way around it by borrowing money off the government, interest-free for 5 years, after which suddenly interest rates kick in for that as well. And so it's not like they don't have to pay this eventually. What are they doing? I edited the story yesterday, and I got Lee to go back and check the numbers because I didn't believe them. The average deposit, according to this study, for London first-time buyers was £100,000. Who are these people?
That's what they're putting down, though, isn't it? They don't necessarily ask for that. That's what they're putting down.
That's what they're putting down. But even if you don't go for 100k, if you assume you basically need 10% for a deposit, and then you can borrow 4.5 times income, you need a good 30 or 40 certainly, and so it's just this increasing disparity whereby anyone whose parents were lucky enough to buy have support to be able to buy their own place, or you have to earn a huge amount of money. But really, even then, even if you're a banker, it's hard to save up that much, especially if you're living the lifestyle of a banker at the same time, which, you know, if you've come out of university and you'll suddenly find yourself earning 60k, you will be doing that. Or you have to have an inheritance, or you have to have tap into one of these funny government schemes that leave you with more debt. There is no way, I think, any longer that anyone who is frugal and saves their money carefully to buy their first home stands a chance of doing so, certainly in the capital, more so out of London. But even so, if people are saving 30 something grand to do so, then what hope does anyone else have?
Personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss, editor Simon Lambert.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Coming up, we're talking about a very Merry Christmas for a number of retailers. But first, Simon, your views about first-time buyers and deposits. Some stats for us?
Yes, I did my own research into this before Christmas, actually. And obviously it comes up with slightly different figures to the Halifax because it probably uses a slightly different source. But 20 years ago, the average deposit put down on a property by a first-time buyer was how much?
20 years ago. The average deposit?
Average deposit, according to the Council of Mortgage
I'll
Lenders.
I'll say 7,000.
£2,095. And that would have taken up 12% of their annual earnings. It's the same statistics, 12%. Today, according to the Council of Mortgage Lenders, it's £24,300. And that takes up 61% of its average first-time buyers' earnings. But there's a crucial point here, right? And that is, if you look at the chart of first-time buyer income over the past 20 years with those statistics, you can almost see this point where it changes from requiring one income to requiring two incomes, because this income figure is the total income of the people taking out the mortgage. Now, that might be one person or it might be two people. Nowadays, it's almost certainly two people, whereas back when you could just raise £2,000 for a deposit, it was quite often one person. And today's deposit would eat up far more than 61% if you only did it on one salary. So actually, the figures are much worse than they look. But yeah, that's a huge difference. So 20 years ago, all you needed to do was save 12% of 1 year's earnings. You get the deposit, get your 95% mortgage, you buy your property. Nowadays, you need to save 61% of what is probably two people's earnings.
I can just hear the number of people going online right now, Simon, to online dating agencies. If you weren't feeling miserable enough about being single, Simon's just stuck the knife in there. We're going to change our subject, though. We're going to talk about retailers. We'll be talking a little bit later about how rich do you feel. Probably not very at the moment after that. But it wasn't just the FTSE's foreign boys grabbing all the attention. Domestic shares not doing too badly either, helped by Super Thursday. Nothing to do with the Bank of England. It is retailers posting their festive trading figures, and boosted no doubt by our This Is Money taste test last month. The German discounters still going great guns. That's despite stores being described this week as looking as if they've been robbed by a load of school kids. Good news also for Morrisons, Tesco and Sainsbury's. Jameson Blake is from ADS Securities London.
I think it's truly, you know, the most wonderful time of year for supermarkets. Both Sainsbury's and Lidl, you know, come out with some really strapping set of results. Although it was only a 0.1%, which seems a bit, you know, not very exciting, it was a vast improvement on the prediction of a drop of 0.8%. So, yeah, Sainsbury's have really done well. You know, supermarkets have been engaged in an ongoing price war for years now, with some of the discount brands causing blow after blow. So, I mean, Sainsbury's has pretty much been a strong player throughout. Market shares remain pretty stable, unlike some of its peers. They saw really good results from their Argos division, also clothing and the online division as well, all provided good results.
Well, Tesco was the big winner of the four supermarkets. It was a Merry Christmas too on the high street for M&S, John Lewis, Primark and Debenhams. Rachel, what stood out for you? Is there a general picture that's emerging here? Is it more positivity for the high street? Was it clicks and bricks? What's your view?
They all did really well. Well, near enough, which is quite rare. Normally you have winners and losers. It seems that everyone is winning at the moment. M&S did what seemed unthinkable about a year ago and increased its profits from clothes. People actually want to buy M&S clothes now again, which is a huge turnaround. Sainsbury's doing well, and Tesco, both particularly boosted by their own brand luxury lines, particularly on Christmas food. So I guess this could all feed into this narrative of people feeling confident about their finances still. Inflation is still low, cost of food is still pretty cheap. We were told things were going to be awful by now and they're not, so people have been spending and having a nice time. And that's sort of reflected across the board in all of the figures.
Going forward though, what are your thoughts? These low prices, particularly at the supermarkets, been fuelled by the price war. Can that go on?
I think for a while, yeah. I mean, prices will probably start to go up because of the effect of the rising pound. But we are so price savvy now that we are going to resist it. We're going to see the same thing happening as we did with Marmite Gate, that supermarkets will resist it on our behalf as well because we are so price sensitive. Mm. We're not loyal anymore to one particular retailer. So if one starts putting up prices, we'll go to another one. So that will certainly help to curb this inflation. And then the longer term outlook, it really depends what happens with the economy. If things tick on as they are, there's no reason why things have to change. But if we do see these things that there have been rumblings about for the past 6 months, with unemployment rates starting to rise, if we have inflation that outpaces wage growth, then it wouldn't take much for people to start thinking, hang on a minute, maybe I should start putting a little bit more away. We have also simultaneously seen debt go up. So credit card debt has been rising very steadily for the past few years. 10% it was up, 10 and a bit percent in November, according to Bank of England stats. Don't know how sustainable that is either.
Well, on that theme, I'm going to ask a slightly subjective, if not a little rude question. Don't worry, you don't have to answer this. How rich are you? How wealthy you are obviously depends on your attitude, your income versus your spending habits and the country you live in. But new figures show Britain is getting more equal. Now, Simon, you've been looking into this, but first, here's Christian Niemitz, Head of Health and Welfare at the Institute of Economic Affairs.
This is more or less in line with the trends that we've seen for the past 25 years. Inequality since the early 1990s has been fairly stable or in some years slightly falling. So this is a continuation of a longer term trend. The interesting thing is that the way we debate inequality is completely out of line with the actual inequality figures. It has become conventional wisdom that inequality is at the highest it's ever been, steadily rising, totally out of control, that the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer all the time, when in fact that is absolutely not what is happening. That has no basis in the figures that we see. It's partly the triple lock for pensions. So pensioners are getting better off in absolute and in relative terms, whereas incomes of a lot of people are still, well, either stagnant or rising only slowly. This is still a legacy to some extent of the financial crisis, which has depressed wages and wages recovering only very slowly. This has happened in previous recessions as well. It's just that this time it's extremely drawn out and long winding.
So, Simon, over to you. You posited this question. How rich are you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. And I knew that people would read that. look, people love reading about this stuff. Firstly, we had a story last week that Becky Rudd written based on some research from money.co.uk that had asked people, you know, whether they felt they were just about managing. And half of people that they polled, which is not a huge number, households this is, mm-hmm. So it's like between the two people, they were earning more than £70,000, said they felt that they were just about managing. Now, predictably, many of our readers were very dismissive of this claim. They're rich, they shouted. But then some other readers said, well, no, hang on a minute. You know, once you take into account all the bills and everything like that, I don't think they are. Oh, no, they aren't, came the reply. So I did some digging into this. And fortunately, actually, the ONS put out its household disposable income statistics this week, which enabled me to use some more recent figures on that. And are they rich? Well, yeah, they are, actually. So a household with £70,000 of income, two working parent family, two children under the age of 13, would have an after-tax income of about £54,000, and that is higher than 76% of the population. So they
surely
are rich.
Surely it depends where you live, though.
Well, of course it does. This is the thing, isn't
all right.
It? £70,000 for a household a year in the North East, you're probably going to feel reasonably flush.
Mm.
If you're in North East London, on the other hand, then you're probably going to feel that you fit just into that just about managing bracket, to be perfectly honest. And what you can do is basically you can drill down into the ONS stats and you can find out where you fit in. So if you're a household and your original income is £35,204, you are the median for the UK. You are the person in the middle if all the households were lined up. And you've got to bear in mind, this is probably a lot of this is dual earner households coming in. The lowest fifth of households have original income of £7,000. The top fifth, £85,000. The IFS has a brilliant where do you fit in calculator that I've linked to in my column. If you want to find it, go to This Is Money, find the article that says how rich are you. The IFS calculator allows you to put in, you have to use your post-tax earnings, which makes it slightly complicated because you've got to work that out. But you put that in and you find out where you are on the line. But of course, it's not just income, is it, that matters? It's also your wealth. And quickly, before we move on to wealth, I should say that if you want to make it into the 1%, the top 1%, you need, as a family of two working parents, two children under the age of 13, to earn £170,000 a year after tax. Quite a lot of money. But wealth, you've got your property wealth, your financial wealth, and your pension wealth. And the ONS does stats on this too, which is the Wealth and Assets Survey. Unfortunately, this is much less frequent. So the most recent one is up to 2014. And it's all net, so it takes into account debt. So your property wealth takes off your mortgage, your financial wealth has all your banks, bank accounts, savings accounts, investments and so on, takes off any debts you have. And then the pension wealth is basically either your defined contribution pot or what your defined benefit pension would pay you, basically. And the median household wealth is £225,000, which is actually quite a lot, actually. The bottom 10% had total wealth of £12,600. The top 10% total wealth of £1,050,000. And if you want to be in the 1%,
mm-hmm.
you will need total household wealth of £2,080,000. £872,600. And if you're in the bottom 1%, you've got negative wealth, -4,434, which, to be perfectly honest, I thought there'd be more people falling into the negative wealth bit, considering the amount of debt that we have. But very interestingly, though, finally, before I stop talking and take a breath and allow you to talk.
Oh, that's fine, Simon. Keep going.
Where does this wealth come from? Well, the ONS stats show that actually overall pension wealth accounts for the largest chunk of the overall figure. Because if you'd asked me, I'd have said property.
Mm.
But actually it's pension wealth. That's 40%, followed by property wealth at 35%. But it's interesting to note that this is massively skewed towards the top decile of households, where 98% have got some pension wealth. And it contributes 43% versus 29% for property. If you go into the lowest half of households, property wealth contributes the most at 34%, and not anywhere near as many people have a pension.
Well, cheery, aren't you? This was the cautious episode, not the really depressing episode.
Just the optimistic thing is, in these ONS statistics, they pointed out that Britain is getting more equal. It's most equal it's been for 30 years. And you use a thing called the Gini coefficient, which is basically a number between 0 and 1. Naught would be if everything was shared equally. One would be if someone had all the money. And our Gini coefficient is falling. On original income, it's falling. But also, once you take into account taxes and benefits, which does a lot to level the playing field, it's down to the lowest level in 30 years, which is news to a lot of people who feel we're getting more unequal. But actually, I think the inequality problem is not to do with the mass wealthy. It's to do with the really small amount of the very, very rich, the executives who earn 129 times the salary of the average worker. And there's a perception problem there. So there might only be a very small number of these people, but people are not happy at exactly how much they have.
It's all right, Simon. I was going to lighten the mood. I was saying, if you are sat there in your job and you're thinking, I deserve to be paid more, you might be thinking it's that time of year, you can get a new one. What about a whole new career? If you aren't sure what you'd like to do, but you know you want more money, you have published on your website the best paid jobs and the biggest pay rises. How does your salary compare to the UK average for your profession? So, Rachel?
This is brilliant. It's published by the ONS every year, and then Rich Browning carefully constructs it into... They produce it as a complicated spreadsheet, and he puts it into a beautiful table, which, if you go onto thisismoney.co.uk, you can find the story, and if you do a control F, search for your occupation, and then it will give you an average for what people are earning now and what people were earning on average last year, so you can see whether it's gone up or down. And from that, you can see the professions that have gained the most over the past year and those that have declined the most. The winners were farmers, followed by care assistants and care escorts, hairdressers, travel assistants and typists. But it's worth noting that none of those are the big earners necessarily. But what we have seen is this introduction of the higher living wage. And so that will have pushed up those jobs.
Concerning, though, for those whose jobs are perhaps dependent on the internet. And what about journalists? How are they doing in there, Rachel? Better than last year?
Don't want to talk about
it. All right, fair enough.
Well, it's a matter of quantity of jobs as well. And if you are looking, actually, for a career change, it's not just the snapshot of what you'd earn now. It's a matter of what's happening to these jobs in future and whether they will still exist.
It's true. And it's the love. It's the love of the job. As well, talking about love, and I'm going to apologise now, Rachel. It does seem to be every time you come in, we have a car story. So, feet up, blame your editor.
I'll just sit here and dream of buses.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you should sit there and just think about the public transport system. Well, that's going to give anyone nightmares. But Simon, this one is for you. You published the best new cars on your website. You've got a minute and a half, go.
Well, these are our favourite new cars. Favourite used cars. So it's basically what people are searching for on Auto Trader. Now, this won't directly translate into what people are buying because there's obviously a supply and demand issue here, and it doesn't necessarily reflect the cars that are in the largest number on the road. But the total advert views, most searched for car on Auto Trader, the BMW 3 Series, followed by the Volkswagen Golf, then the Mercedes C-Class, and then the Ford Focus, BMW 5 Series, BMW 1 Series, Ford Fiesta, which is the biggest selling new car, Audi A3, Mercedes E-Class, Vauxhall Astra. Actually, what this tells you about is if you pick out the ones here that aren't the biggest selling new cars, is it shows you what has pricing power, basically. So BMW secondhand prices are very, very robust. And that is because a lot of people are searching for them used, but not so many people are buying them new. So a 3 Series doesn't even make it into the top 10 selling new cars. A Fiesta, on the other hand, if you're after a cheap runabout, that's the biggest selling new car, one of the most searched for, but it's only number 7 in this list. So actually, you probably get a good deal on a Ford Fiesta. So if you want the biggest bargain, maybe compare the two lists. If you want status, maybe just go with the one everyone's searching for and get that BMW, isn't it?
What gets your vote, Simon? Dream big.
Oh, I don't know. If I could have any brand new car today, I would have a Jaguar F-Type Coupe. That's what I'd search for.
And Rachel, you?
Well, I'm looking at that list, and Mini, that sounds smaller than the rest of them and most energy efficient.
Brilliant,
so
yeah.
I think that's the one for me.
Great.
Thanks.
You want an original Mini, that's a proper Mini, not these new big ones.
So next driving story, not written by Rachel. Rachel Rickard-Strauss, personal finance editor, and editor Simon Lambert, thank you so much for joining us.